needed. We have now to hear from the plaintiffs, and the first attorney is Tamara Packard. 5 minutes.
Justice, good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Tamara Packard from Cullen Weston Pines and Bach, LLP. I and my partner Lester Pines appear today on behalf of the plaintiffs Madison Teachers Incorporated and Peggy Coyne. Our colleague M. Nicole Padway of Padway and Padway appears today on behalf of the plaintiffs Public Employees Local 61 and John Wegman. I'll be addressing the defendant's request for a stay of the circuit court's judgment as to the amendments of MERA, or to MERA. We've designated 5 minutes for this. Attorney Padway will then use 15 minutes to address the home rule and impairment of contract challenges to Act 10 in relation to the Milwaukee Employees Retirement System. And then Attorney Pines will use the remaining 25 minutes to argue the speech association and equal protection challenges to the amendments to MERA made through Act 10. I have 2 points that I'd like to make about the state's request for stay.
First, who are you representing in this on the stay?
We represent only Madison Teachers and Peggy Coyne. We do not represent the non-party unions who got the stay. Contempt.
Good.
Well,
they obtained the contempt order. Okay.
That's correct. But and this goes directly to that first point, regardless of how the court decides to address the contempt ruling, the defendants, the WERC commissioners and Governor Walker, have been acting in violation of the circuit court's September 14, 2012 judgment since this spring, since the federal court injunction was lifted. Is that having failed in their efforts to obtain a stay of that original judgment, of that original declaratory judgment ruling from the circuit court first in October 12 and then from the Court of Appeals in May 2013, it is far too late for them to now seek a stay of that judgment from this court. This court should deny the motions for stay and explain that the commissioners must not enforce or implement the voided portions of MERA until and unless the circuit court's ruling is reversed or modified by this court. This first point really goes to Justice Ziegler's question. She asked, how does the circuit court claim to have jurisdiction to claim what is on appeal? And the answer is that the contempt order did not fundamentally change its original order. The original order had the effect of an injunction. Now, the defendants...
Counselor, how can it have the effect of an injunction when you twice specifically asked for an injunction and the court said no, that you weren't irreparably harmed, the only harm you were talking about was harm to non-parties? Can you explain that to me?
Certainly, Justice Rogensack. The circuit court actually didn't deny us a request, deny us an injunction. The circuit court was simply silent on the request for an injunction, and a declaratory judgment is in its nature injunctive relief. And that is from PRN Associates. A declaratory judgment provides a remedy which is primarily anticipatory and preventative, similar to injunctive relief. When a statute is declared facially unconstitutional, it is null and void from its inception. And that's State versus Wood, a decision from this court in 2010. A legislative act that is contrary to the Constitution is not law. And, of course, circuit courts have the authority to decide constitutional questions. So a court need not expressly enjoin state officials, all of whom have taken an oath to uphold and defend the Wisconsin Constitution, from enforcing or implementing a legislative act which has been declared unconstitutional. If it has been declared unconstitutional on its face, null and void, and without effect, as the circuit court's original judgment ruled, they can't act on something that is not law, and they should not act on something that is not law. Requiring an explicit injunction in a declaratory judgment action like this one, which challenged the facial constitutionality of a statute, as the U.S. Supreme Court said in McComb versus Jackson Paper, that would give tremendous impetus to the program of experimentation with disobedience of the law. So in the absence of a stay or other subsequent order, as of September 14, 2012, the commissioners and the governor had no authority to enforce or implement the provisions of Act 10 that were declared to be unconstitutional, null and void, and without effect. Now, to the extent that there was any actual confusion about what authority the defendants had and did not have to implement the nullified portions of MERA, the Circuit Court actually recently clarified that in its September 17, 2013 decision and order, saying that the defendants are bound by the court's judgment even as to non-parties. That was a clarification. I don't think that that was a modification of the original ruling, because once a statute is declared unconstitutional, it can't be used.
As I read that that order, the trial court was persuaded that the defendants were state officials, sued as state officials, and therefore bound as state officials to, in all of its actions, to adhere to his order.
I think that is a fair reading of the trial court's ruling, Your Honor.
Isn't that the basis of his ruling?
Yes. A declaratory judgment action challenging the constitutionality of a state statute is properly brought against the state agency and or the state officials who are challenged with the administration of that statute, and that's Lister versus Board of Regents. So such an action is brought against state officials on the premise that the officers are acting outside the bounds of their constitutional or jurisdictional authority by enforcing or implementing the law. That is exactly the premise of this case, of this lawsuit, and precisely why the plaintiffs sued the WERC commissioners and the governor in this case.
Sounds to me as if your argument is based that it's the same judgment, same order, that was in September 2012, and that the state work are too late.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, but, the answer to that, or an answer, is things changed, according to the state, because as of September 2013 or October 2013, it was clear now that the order affected work in its entirety, that is, over the entire state. And so only when that became clear to the state did the state have to come back to court. So how do you answer that? So that they say that's timely.
To quote Attorney St. John, ignorance of the law is no excuse. It has been the law of this state for decades that when a law is declared to be unconstitutional, it cannot be enforced under any circumstances against anyone until and unless an appropriate court narrows that application.
For clarification, you're talking about facially unconstitutional as opposed to applied unconstitutional.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. When it's facially unconstitutional.
When a statute is declared to be facially unconstitutional. And to the extent that they were confused by the Court of Appeals, Mr. St. John indicated that they relied on the Court of Appeals telling them that there was no statewide effect. Now, that idea, I think, was developed, that read of the Court of Appeals came from the Court of Appeals December 28, 2012 order, where they asked the parties to supplement their briefing.
Counselor, I asked you an initial question about an injunction, and your response to me was that you didn't seek an injunction and the court didn't rule on it. But I have before me a September 17, 2013 order that denies the plaintiff appellant's request for an injunction. Can you square your first answer with the document that I have from which I phrased my
I'm sorry,
question?
Justice Rogenczak, we did originally seek an injunction.
And it was denied.
The circuit court did not originally deny it in its original order. We then did seek an injunction, you're correct, in the spring, after it became apparent, this spring of 2013, after it became apparent that the WERC commissioners were not just preparing to implement the provisions of Act 10, should it be found to be constitutional.
But the circuit court did deny a petition for an injunction.
The circuit court denied a petition for injunction on the basis that we did not have any harm because the commissioners were not enforcing the Act 10 provisions against us.
Well, the basis were probably whatever bases were argued, and I agree that the order does say that you haven't shown irreparable harm to you, and raising harm to third parties or persons who are not part of the litigation, the court was unaware or given any authority that that could be the basis for the injunction you sought, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
It's too long a question to be worth repeating, okay? There simply was an injunction denied earlier to the plaintiff's appellant. That's the point I wanted to get clarification on
the basis that the WERC was not enforcing Act 10 against us, against the plaintiffs here.
That's the second denial, 2013 denial.
Correct.
First time you got a the trial court was silent, right?
First time the trial court just decided and issued a declaratory judgment saying that the laws were unconstitutional, null and void, and couldn't and had no effect. That should have prevented all of the defendants from then implementing those laws, and unfortunately it didn't.
And in September 2013, you did not get an injunction because you had no standing for an injunction because this Act 10 was not being enforced against you, so you were not being hurt.
Exactly right.
Okay. Which leads me to ask you, should the court stay the order of 2012 and subsequent orders undefined, should we stay that?
No.
What's the effect on you of the stay? What's the effect on other unions on the stay? And how does the court, on fairness principles or any other principles, change a statute?
The effect to MTI and the laborers, Local 61, to a stay of the circuit court's September 2012 ruling would be to put these parties to put the provisions of Act 10 on these parties. So we would then have to start complying with the requirements of Act 10. The WERC could impose the requirements of Act 10 on, would, I'm sure, impose the requirements of Act 10 on these parties.
Can you comply with Act 10?
Would we?
Can you?
Your Honor, I don't know what would be required.
Well, you didn't file on in August, did you?
We did. I don't believe we did.
All right. Can you file back in August 2013 now?
Well, no.
Can you meet
the... We could not do that.
All right. According to the emergency rules, this says this. These emergency rules are not applicable to the plaintiffs in 11 CV 3744. I think that's you.
That would be us.
Unless and until the circuit court's decision is no longer in effect. So if we issue a stay, it looks as if work would say, too bad, so sad, you're out of luck.
That is a possible outcome. In terms of other parties, of course, I can't speak to the moving unions who are not parties to this case. But what I can
point out... But would be affected by a stay.
They would be... They would all unions and all municipalities would be affected by a stay. The unions...
Well, so would all teachers and municipal employees and everybody else.
Yes. I mean, as would the WERC commissioners, as would all of the... Yes.
I understood your response in regard to Judge Colas's not granting the injunction because work had not been moving towards or holding the elections. But doesn't that sort of beg the question? I mean, here we are. Today we're called upon to decide the substantive issue as to the substantive merits of Act 10. And so if, hypothetically, it is found that Judge Colas was incorrect, wouldn't it have been prudent for the state to have been preparing for elections, as the state was not sitting idle, I don't think. I think they were fighting Act 10 legal matters in many different forums and many different jurisdictions.
Justice Gableman, what I would say to that is that preparing for those elections internally, drafting their rules, saying if and when Act 10 is found to be constitutional, these are the rules we're going to apply. I don't think that anyone would have a great deal of problem with that. The problem is that they then went ahead and passed those rules and then required unions and municipalities around the state to follow those rules and to expend a great deal of money and time and effort to follow those rules.
And that's what prompted the most recent litigation.
Yes. And, of course, the damage that would be done to unions and employees if a stay were granted is it would continue. Because, of course, if this court grants a stay while we are waiting for a decision on the merits, those unions will go ahead and continue to engage in the work and spend the resources necessary to win those campaigns. And that is something that can't be taken back. That is an irreparable harm. As opposed, as Justice Bratley noticed, to the work that work might need to do.
Let me ask a question. How would the union's work be any different than what the state would have to do?
What the state would be doing...
The state would be expending money, expending resources, expending employee time, and so would the union. So how is it that we are to decide which irreparable harm is more irreparable?
Well, I think that is well answered by comparing the status of these plaintiffs, MTI and Local 61, to the other municipal unions who are currently, according to WRC, obligated to follow the provisions of Act 10. It's not just the cost of the campaigns and the lost time to engage in them, but it's also the difference between what these different collective bargaining agents and the municipal employers that are working with them, it's the difference of what they can talk about. It's what they can negotiate. It's what they can ultimately agree to. The full panoply of rights is something that MTI and any union that is covered by the declaration of unconstitutionality has, versus those unions, if a stay were granted, which would be all unions, who can't negotiate almost anything. So that becomes irreparable harm.
Okay. But again, I guess I would just observe, and I'd invite you to respond to it, that the state, if a stay was not granted, that the state would be in a similar situation. They would be bargaining. They would be compelled to bargain for things that if ultimately, hypothetically, the act was not established beyond a reasonable doubt as unconstitutional, wouldn't there be irreparable harm there, too?
The state is not governed by the Municipal Employment Relations Act, Your Honor. They are covered by CELRA, and CELRA is unaffected. We have not challenged Act 10 as it applies to the state.
Counsel, I asked you three questions. One, what's the effect on MTI if there's a stay? And there was a question you're not sure, and the emergency rules would indicate tough luck because you would be immediately affected and you did not comply with Act 10 in August, right?
So yes.
You would be decertified or not certified. It would look that way.
Your Honor, the reason I'm being hesitant on answering that is it's not in the record, but I believe that at least MTI has negotiated a successor contract that keeps it outside of the purview of Act 10 for a period of time. But what that period of time is, to be honest, I don't exactly know.
Right. But if we didn't know any of that, it would look like there were issues here.
Absolutely.
Okay. What's the effect on the other unions that are not in this case? And they did not comply in August because they thought they were covered by your lawsuit.
That's correct.
They're out of luck, too.
They're out of luck.
Okay. So they can't get certified.
That would be my understanding.
All right. The third question I had for you is, in the doctrine of fairness here, can the court change the statute? Now, I'm looking at the statute, and, you know, it is so dense that I can't figure out what the section number is, frankly. So I will call your attention to the statute that's in the appendix of the defendant appellants, and I'm on page 163, okay? And it's 3B. 3B. If you can give me the full number, I think it may be 111.74. And then I got as far as CG, but then I lost the numbering. But it says this. Annually, the commission shall conduct an election to certify the representative of the collective bargaining unit that contains a general municipal employee, right? The election shall occur no later than December 1, that's a statutory timeline, for a collective bargaining unit containing school district employees, that's this case, right? And no later than May 1 for collective bargaining unit containing general municipal employees who are not school district employees.
Yes.
So, what's the authority of this court to set the election after December 1, I'm sorry?
I am unaware of any authority that allows this court to do that.
What about equity, fairness, equitable?
Does that give us the opportunity to amend
the statute?
I am unaware of anything that allows this court to amend the statute, whether that is statutory, case law, equitable powers. I am aware of nothing that would allow you to do that.
What about an administrative agency? Oftentimes, and I don't know here, there's a provision that in a statute that allows them to enact rules consistent with whatever the language says in the statute. Does a administrative agency, does the administrative agency in this case, does WERC have the authority to change December 1st date? I know their rules allow them to do that, but beyond their own rules, is there authority for that, if you know?
I am unaware of any authority that would allow the an administrative agency to amend the statutes. I have seen in other contexts where a statute actually says, and if the agency wants to modify this kind of provision, they have the authority to do that. I don't believe such a provision was included in Act 10, and I don't believe such a provision exists in 11170, either before or since Act 10.
And so what you seem to be saying is neither this court nor anyone else can enforce the statutory deadlines, but hypothetically, a circuit court judge who gets it wrong can prevent a party from meeting a statutory deadline. Is that what you're saying?
Justice Gableman, what I'm saying is that the commissioners and the governor had 7 months between the time that the Court of Appeals denied it a stay of the September 2012 decision and order. They didn't ask this court for a stay.
Perhaps my question wasn't clear enough. I think you're answering yes.
I don't know how else to answer that question, Your Honor.
Really? It's pretty straightforward. You're in response to Justice Bradley and Chief Justice Abrahamson. You agreed with both of their propositions that, no, neither this court nor any administrative agency can make any alterations so that the state could meet its statutory deadline. However, the converse of that is, hypothetically, if a circuit court judge gets a substantive ruling wrong in regard to the constitutionality of a provision, he or she can effectively prevent a party from meeting a statutory deadline.
Justice Gableman, circuit court judges have the authority.
Oh, yes, I was a circuit court judge for 6 years. So.
And I understand that. And so you know that as a circuit court judge, you had the authority to rule that a statute was unconstitutional on its face. It used to be in this state that circuit courts couldn't answer constitutional questions, and they had to get kicked up to the Supreme Court. But that was changed decades ago. And so, as you know, for the
thank you for the review of history. But if that's the best you can do to answer my question, that's fine.
Oh, well, counsel, I thought municipal court judges can even declare constitutionality. The real question is here, and maybe you're not the attorney to answer it, is can somebody who is ordered by the court, or can somebody who's a party, a state official, and there's a declaration of nullity, even if the state official thinks it's wrong, can the state official act contrary to the court declaration?
There is no authority for such an official to do so.
The state official cannot determine the constitutionality contrary to the trial court, even if the trial court is dead wrong.
Even if the trial court is dead wrong, Your Honor, and that is basically a separation of powers concept. It is the courts that have the authority to declare what the law is. And administrative officials have the obligation to apply the Constitution as that has been interpreted by the courts. So until and unless the trial court's decision is altered or stayed, which the state, which the defendants attempted to do several times, unsuccessfully, they should not have been implementing the provisions that were declared unconstitutional. They implemented null provisions of MERA, and they persist now in claiming that in the absence of an explicit injunction directed at them, that there are actually two constitutions. That there is a constitution that applies to these plaintiffs, and then there is a constitution that applies to the other non-parties to this action. And that's just nonsensical. When a facial challenge to a statute is made under the Declaratory Judgments Act, a decision in favor of the challenger directly affects all those subject to the statute, regardless of whether they participated in the litigation. And that is what the Court of Appeals said in the Helgeland decision, which was upheld by this court. And as this court said in Helgeland, on a practical level...
Can you address home rule a little bit? We're kind of going on and on about the stay, which was to be 5 minutes, and I'm really very interested in home rule. I find it to be a very difficult area for us to address. Do you want to proceed to home rule, please?
Your Honor, I am not prepared to discuss home rule.
No,
Mr. Padley will.
Counsel, I've given you extra time because of all the time that was given to the opposite side on this, to be fair to you. So I've sort of kept time as to how much was given to the other side, and I'm trying to be fair. So you should continue on. I think you've got about 5 more minutes if you want to use them, but you don't have to.
I would appreciate that opportunity, Your Honor.
I ask a couple of questions. You represent Madison Teachers and Peggy Coyne.
That's correct.
How did the commissioners prejudice their rights? How did the commissioners, the WVRC commissioners, prejudice the rights of Madison Teachers and Peggy Coyne?
You mean by implementing Act 10? You mean why did we bring the lawsuit to begin with?
In any way, how did they prejudice the rights of Madison Teachers Incorporated and Peggy Coyne in such a way that they should be held in contempt?
Your Honor, we did not obtain the contempt order, and I actually would offer that the contempt order is really a red herring, that regardless of whether there was a contempt order, from September 14, 2012, the commissioners had no legal ability to implement Act 10, not just to the plaintiffs in this case, but to all parties, all non-parties, all people.
Oh, okay. I understand your argument, but did the commissioners do anything to any of the named plaintiffs in this case that should result in contempt?
That should result in contempt. I believe that the trial court determined that there was no harm to the plaintiffs in this case because the WERC was interpreting the trial court's decision as applying to everybody but the plaintiffs in this case.
That's why you didn't make any motion for contempt. That's why you did not move or join the contempt motion.
Exactly, Your Honor. Now, we did ask the court to clarify or to provide the explicit injunction that the commissioners believed that ought to exist if they were not to apply this statute to anyone, and the court declined that, again, for the same reason, because the WERC was not applying Act 10 to us. That required other people who were being affected by Act 10 to come in and seek enforcement of the underlying judgment from September 2012.
But could I ask this? Do the WERC commissioners in some way have something to do with recertification elections on unions, labor unions representing state employees?
The state employee recertification elections that are required under Act 10 are unaffected by the trial court's ruling in this case.
No, but what I'm saying is, do the commissioners have something to do with those recertification elections?
Do they have something to do with them? I believe so. I believe that they run those elections.
Okay. So in substance, is there any difference between the provisions that apply to labor organizations, representatives, for state employees than for municipal employees? Is there any substance whatsoever?
I don't know. It's not a question that I don't represent state employees. I only represent MTI, and we only represent municipal employees.
So are you saying that commissioners were not in any way in contempt of the circuit court when they conducted recertification elections for unions representing state employees?
That's correct. The trial court ruling only dealt with MERA and not CELRA. The State Employment Relations Act governs elections for state employees, and MERA...
Isn't it kind of curious that if the provisions applying to state employees are identical to the provisions applying to municipal employees, why could the commissioners conduct elections for some but not for the others?
Well, because courts are not supposed to provide advisory opinions. And the parties who brought this case were municipal employees and their unions. They were not state employees and their unions. And to the extent that you're getting at Justice Markson's decision, that case was brought under different theories. And it's just incorrect to say that that ruling somehow has any effect on the merits of this case.
Could I go back to something that Justice Rogenczyk asked? When the case was before Judge Kolas in September of 2012, you folks asked for an injunction.
That's correct.
That's part of the pleadings.
Yes.
You asked for a whole lot of other things, and you got most of what you wanted. But now, in that opinion, I believe Judge Kolas failed to say something that you wanted about fair share. Is that right? Left it out.
Is that right? In sentence? Is that what you're...
I believe that's correct.
Sure. Okay. And somehow, you conveyed to Judge Kolas the fact that he ought to fix that up. Is that right?
That's correct. We did ask for a clarification of the original ruling.
Okay. But when he left out any reference to an injunction, did you ask for him to say something?
We did not, and we did not because it shouldn't have been necessary. Because
why did you ask for it in the first place?
That's a good question. And I have to say that when we started down the path of this litigation, we didn't necessarily fully understand the law as well as we did by the time we got to the decision itself. And so by the time we got to the decision itself, we knew that a declaratory judgment had injunctive nature to it. And we knew that when the court said that the statutes that we challenged were null and void and had no effect, we knew that those officers should not then implement those things that were not law anymore, or at least were not law so long as the trial court's ruling stood. So in rejecting what I'll – we shouldn't have had to have brought this as a class action. And, in fact, Your Honor, you said that yourself in the Helgeland case in the dissent. You said, as a practical matter, that Helgeland case was equivalent to a class action. We didn't need to bring it as a class action in order to get the full relief that we sought. And, of course, the majority in the Helgeland case seemed to agree with that concept. They said that on a practical level, which is the level at which the analysis must focus, quote, the municipalities, who in that case were not parties, arguably may be affected if a judgment is entered against the agency, DETF, in that case. So in rejecting the proposition that a declaratory judgment action should be brought as a class action in order to effectively prevent enforcement of a void legislative enactment, this court said only 6 years ago in the majority decision in Helgeland, the valuable remedy of declaratory judgment would be rendered impractical and indeed often worthless for determining the validity of legislative enactments, either state or local, since such enactments commonly affect the interests of large numbers of people. And that's in the Helgeland decision at paragraph 140, quoting Town of Blooming Grove.
Counsel, your time is nearly up.
I just want to follow up on one of Justice Prosser's questions, because I didn't totally understand your answer. Perhaps I missed the question. It is, as I understood it, essentially asking, is WERCA precluded by Judge Colas's decision from certifying the elections with regard to state employees? That's what I understood it to be proceeding towards.
And the answer is no.
And I don't know why the answer is no, given your theory of the case.
Because no judge has told them that.
Could be. I mean, that could be. But I look at the September 17th, 2013 decision of Judge Colas, and on my page to the last paragraph, essentially he's saying the question here is not whether other courts or non-parties are bound by this ruling. It is whether the defendants are bound by it, he says. Plainly they are, as all parties to a lawsuit are, in a case in which the statute was found facially unconstitutional, they may not enforce it under any circumstances against anyone. And so I, you know, you may not agree with his statements there, and therefore it may have you answer Justice Prosser's question as though in the way you did, they're not precluded. But as I interpret Judge Colas' September 17, 2013 decision, I thought under that he would argue they are precluded. Doesn't matter, he says, who the plaintiffs are. Doesn't matter if they're parties or non-parties, because what matters, according to the September 27, 2013 decision of Judge Colas, is who are my defendants? And this is a facial challenge, not an as-applied challenge. And I'm telling a party, the defendants in this action, you cannot enforce that. So that's the way I'd interpret it. How do you square your answer with my interpretation, which may or may not be correct, and Judge Colas' opinion?
I think the state employees would love to hear your interpretation as the interpretation of the court.
No, I don't mean that. I'm not suggesting that's my interpretation. I'm saying that your answer that, no, they're not precluded, to me is inconsistent with Judge Colas' decision.
Well, Judge Colas' decision, I 100% agree with the portion of the decision that you just read. I think where the disconnect is that Judge Colas found portions of MERA to be unconstitutional.
I suggest you look at page 150. I'm using the appendix of the appellant and looking at his order of September 14.
Yes. And so the statutes that he found unconstitutional, or the provisions that he found to be unconstitutional, were provisions within the Municipal Employee Relations Act, not provisions within the State Employees Relations Act.
Fair enough.
He listed them.
Exactly.
Fair enough. I guess I get caught with the conundrum that it is my understanding that they're verbatim for states, but I understand your answer now.
Counsel?
Would you like me to
rest on an upbeat?
All right. How about let me just close. The plaintiffs urge the court to deny the defendant's request for stay. The court must instead make clear that the defendants and governmental officials who come after them, that they must respect the authority of the judicial branch. They are not to enforce or implement a law that has been declared by any court of this state to be facially unconstitutional, null and void, and without effect, absent a stay, which the state could get potentially and could seek, but did not seek from this court until 7 months after it was denied by the Court of Appeals, until and unless such ruling is modified on appeal. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms.
Packard. Mr. Padway, you have 15 minutes. In fairness to the other side, closer count here to the 15.
Pardon?
Closer count to your 15.
I understand, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Chief Justice Abramson, I am Attorney M. Nicole Padway. I represent Public Employees Union Local 61 and John Wegman. I'm here to principally address the Court's determination that Act 10 is unconstitutional for two respects with regard to the City of Milwaukee's employee retirement system, first, under the home rule provision of our state's constitution, and secondly, that it amounts to an unconstitutional impairment of vested contractual rights. And I'll pick up immediately with respect to Justice Rogensack's concern with respect to the uniformity clause with respect to the home rule provision. If we look at the plain language of Article 11, Section 3, Paragraph 1, cities and villages organized pursuant to state law may determine their local affairs and government subject only to this Constitution and to such enactments of the legislature of statewide concern as with uniformity shall affect every city or every village. The clear language of this Act reserves local affairs of government to the local municipalities and local villages, subject only to two constraints, the Constitution and then legislative actions of statewide concern as with uniformity. And it's important to note that statewide concern comes before the uniformity language. The legislature, the people of this state, in forming the Constitution, said that the statewide concern was paramount. Importantly, it does not reflect the converse. By that I mean it doesn't say that we're reserving everything to the legislature unless the legislature says to a local municipality or village that you can do this, that, or the other thing. This particular constitutional section provides to the municipalities the ability to govern their own local affairs subject to very strict constraints.
So if I understood the state, they said if it's uniform, it shows it's statewide concern.
Simply because it's uniform.
Yeah.
I would beg to, well, I obviously differ with their interpretation because what we've found through the different cases that deal with this particular issue, and there are a handful of them, the courts have looked at it and said we have matters that are primarily of local concern, we have matters that are of statewide concern, and then we have matters that are mixed. So we have this three different sections which come into play.
Which is this?
This one, from our perspective, is strictly a local affair. And if we look at, if we look at the history of the Milwaukee employee retirement system, we can easily ascertain that this is a matter strictly of local affair, is not mixed, and is not something that is of a statewide concern. The initial enactment for the Milwaukee ERS came out of some 1937 legislation by the legislature. And at that time, it created an entire employee retirement system for the city. That was followed in 1947 by a special session law that reads as follows. For purposes of giving to cities of the first class the largest measure of self-government with respect to pension and annuity and retirement systems compatible with the Constitution and general law, it is hereby declared to be the legislative policy that all future amendments and alterations to this Act are matters of local affair and government and shall not be construed as an enactment of statewide concern. So in 1947, the legislature ceded to the City of Milwaukee its control over the employee retirement system. And when the City of Milwaukee adopted the employee retirement system, it adopted it not as a general ordinance, but but rather as a charter ordinance. And under our statutes, a charter ordinance has special effect. It is basically a designation that this is a matter of local affair that will be covered and governed by the municipality itself.
Counselor, if this all started out with the 1937 enactment, which I thought was interesting because I had a really hard time finding it since it's not put together in the usual way, but I have a copy of it. If it all started out by the legislature with that enactment, so the Milwaukee retirement system starts out with the legislature. And then in 1947, the legislature passes the law saying only the municipalities can change this. Is that a correct delegation of what had been legislative authority to a municipality? And tell me yes or no, why?
I think it's an appropriate delegation to the municipality, and I'll explain in this particular instance why it is such. If you look at the pension systems that we deal with in this state, there are principally three major systems. There's the Wisconsin retirement system, Milwaukee County has a system, and then there's the city employee retirement system. The WRS is a system that covers state workers, school teachers. It covers a whole host of public protective services. It covers a wide scope of individuals. It's contributed to by multiple jurisdictions. In the same vein, well, Milwaukee County is different in a number of different respects. Milwaukee County is different because, first of all, it's comprised of multiple jurisdictions. It gets its authority not by virtue of a charter ordinance, but rather the county's home rule authority comes out of a legislative determination by the legislature, as opposed to charter ordinances for the city of Milwaukee, which is a constitutional creation. And the third feature is, if you look at the city of Milwaukee's pension, it is funded solely by the city of Milwaukee, and it concerns beneficiaries who are solely city employees. Of the various pension systems that we have in this state, this particular system, the one that was ceded by the legislature to Milwaukee, is the only one that has comprised of a single jurisdiction that deals solely with its own employees and is funded solely by its own municipal purse.
Why does that make the delegation proper? My concern was whether there was an inappropriate delegation of legislative authority, because you're telling me, and I agree, that this began as a legislative enactment, okay? Then later on, the legislature says, oh, no more. Anytime this is changed in the future, it has to be done by the municipality. It's that second 1947 act that I am concerned with, and what I'm trying to evaluate is, why is that an appropriate delegation of legislative authority, pretty much irrevocably, as you're telling us, to a municipality?
It's an appropriate delegation with a caveat. Okay. And I will tell you what the caveat is, and that was the Association of State Prosecutors case, which basically says that there are certain limited circumstances in which the legislature can intervene, and that is with respect to whether or not the particular plan is properly funded. In other words, is this a plan that is at risk? And if looking at that Association of State Prosecutors case, it's very clear that with respect to that particular element, whether or not this is properly funded, whether it's an at-risk situation, then, in that event, the legislature could intervene. But with respect to that particular exception, the state legislature decreed as a matter of policy that the city of Milwaukee, which, and I don't want to give any history lessons here, but at the time that this was done was at a different point in time when the city of Milwaukee was a very large institution, and I think the reason for the original 37 enactment was to say to the city, you need a pension, And for all the reasons why we want to have a pension, you need to have one. And then in 47, the legislature said, this is yours to deal with, and you must deal responsibly with it.
Thank you.
Is this pension plan at risk?
No.
We know?
And I
would
point out that if we look at the record, there's nothing in the record to show that the city of Milwaukee's pension is at risk. If anything, it is one of the best funded plans throughout the country.
How do we know
there's
that?
We don't know that in the record either.
How do we? Well, but...
It is a properly funded plan. There's nothing in the record to show that it was at risk when Act 10 was promulgated. And I would point out that if you look at what the city has done with respect to its pension fund, before Act 10 came into being, before Governor Walker was even elected, the city negotiated with its unions and worked out contractually that essentially, starting as of January 1, 2010, for employees hired, not for existing employees, but for employees hired, they would start to make the pension contribution, the 5.5%. But that was done through a proper legislative process by an amendment of the city's charter ordinance. And if we go back to the, and I haven't had a chance to get into the contract, the impairment of contract, but if we look at the ordinances dealing with the impairment of contract, the fact that in 1971, that is the time when the city said, we are going to pick up and we're going to pay this 5.5% on behalf of the employees. At the same time they did that, they also adopted a provision saying, and this is not going to change. We're going to do this now and prospectively for all employees hired as of the date this charter ordinance is in effect. Again, going into a little bit of history, in the early 70s, inflation was rampant. It was not uncommon to have 7, 8, 9, 10% increases in salaries. The city and its unions met, and the city said, we'll pay this portion on your behalf. We're not going to give you the same wages. And there was an economic benefit to both the employees and the city. The benefit is, in terms of the funding for the pension, by keeping wages low, and because the pension is ultimately computed based on their wages, lower wages, lower pension benefits led to better funding of the pension system. From the employee side, they were getting a benefit, meaning the city was paying the 5.5%. Both parties benefited in that neither had to contribute Social Security to the federal government on the amounts that were now going into the pension fund.
Could I ask you a question? If you prevail and the city of Milwaukee's employees don't have to contribute the 5.5%, what is the effect on other cities and villages?
There's absolutely no effect on any other city or any other village because the city's fund or plan is solely funded by the city.
Oh, no, what I'm trying to say is, wouldn't that destroy the uniformity that affects other pension operations?
No, I don't believe it would have any effect on any pension operation because this is a city plan that's funded by the city.
Let's say the city of Madison says, we're perfectly willing to pay all of the money toward the pensions. We don't want to exact 5.5%. It seems to me the law says, well, you have to do that. But the Home Rule Amendment applies to Madison, doesn't it?
It does apply to Madison.
And Wausau? And Appleton? And Green Bay?
You're correct, but there is no determination saying that this is a matter of local affairs or concerns, number one. And that designation that the city of Milwaukee is now responsible for its own pension is what controls.
You're saying this is not a matter of statewide concern.
That is correct.
And you want to make it non-uniform. I mean, doesn't that affect the Act 10 with respect to every other city and village?
That is, here's the issue there. The issue is, how do municipalities want to govern their own purse? Where do they want to spend their money? And with respect to matters of local affair, the cities should have the right. If a city wants to pick up that benefit and pay it and say to the union, instead, we're not going to give you a wage increase. We're going to keep your wages low, but we're going to pay this. It's the same dollars. It's just how they're being allocated. And what Act 10, with respect to the city of Milwaukee, definitely, because the city is operating as a matter of designation in control of its own local affairs with respect to this. But quite frankly, Act 10, as a policy matter, has taken a tool, if you will, away from municipalities in how they negotiate. Well, there's no negotiations anymore, but they can't even do it if they wanted to, because they felt they'd rather give this benefit to their employees as opposed to saying, we're going to give you a wage increase. They don't even have that ability anymore.
Mr. Padway, let me follow through with Justice Prosser's question, because I think he and I are expressing some of the same concerns. Let's assume that the test in regard to home rule is both statewide concern and uniformity. In regard to uniformity, I think it's interesting to note that Act 10 has the same prohibition in regard to all local governments, cities, towns, and villages, not just in regard to a first-class city such as Milwaukee. In addition to that, it seems to me that a strong argument can be made that if the dollars that no longer have to be spent in regard to the city paying the employee's contribution to the pension plan can be allocated for other expenses, that reduces the amount of state aid that would be required. That strikes me as statewide concern and uniformity. And I think what Justice Prosser was asking you is, if somehow or other we select the city of Milwaukee and say it's okay for the city of Milwaukee to make the contribution for the employee share, but everybody else is prohibited, all other local governments are prohibited from doing so, what does that do to uniformity?
All right. Let me answer it this way, because the concern you've raised is, if Milwaukee has to do this, but everybody else, Milwaukee has the opportunity to do what it wants, but everybody else is subject to the constraints of Act 10, isn't that going to affect Milwaukee's budget, and isn't it going to affect the state, because the state's going to have to give more money to Milwaukee because they're giving more money to the employees?
That's
under
exactly
the shared revenue. Well, let's look at the factors of shared revenue. Under Chapter 79, when we look at the factors that are considered by shared revenue, it's population, it's revenue, it's property values, it's public utility values, and it is budget size versus expenditure restraints. And the way shared revenue works, so first of all, none of the factors involved in shared revenue focus on how the city decides to spend each dollar. They're predicated on totally different factors. And if we look at how, if the city were to exceed its budget restraint under the shared revenue formula, their revenue goes down from the state. if they violate it. So the city has to figure out, based on its local affairs and concerns, how it's going to allocate its dollars. And it should have that right, as Madison should have that right, as Appleton should have that right. They've got a pot of money. They have to decide how they want to allocate it. It does not affect how much money they get from the state. And given that feature, that is why, that's the whole basis behind the Home Rule Amendment, is we need to give the municipalities the opportunity to decide what's in the best interest of their local affairs. If you look at Waukesha and if you look at the city of Milwaukee, they abut against each other. There's a border there. But the needs of the respective municipalities, the way the people seek to live their lives, may be completely different.
What about the uniformity aspect of all of this? If you say the city of Milwaukee can do one thing, all other local governments are prohibited from doing what the city of Milwaukee can do, what do you do with uniformity?
As I said, as I understand the law and the history of the cases, that there are two criteria. It must both be of statewide concern, and it must be uniformly applied. And given that this, the Milwaukee ERS, is not a matter of statewide concern, either from revenue funding from the state or from the way in which it gets funded from its city, from its own public purse, or the people who receive the benefit, it's strictly a local concern.
Council, can't the legislature have decided that the state was in economic crisis and it needed, in order to turn that around, the assistance of all of the municipalities, and it wasn't directing them to spend $1 here, it was saying we're going to relieve you of these responsibilities. So you have extra money left over and you can spend it for economic development, bring more jobs to Milwaukee. Why isn't that something that really is of statewide concern and would cut against the argument you make for this being a purely local matter?
Well, I would answer that this way. First of all, we have to look at attracting quality employees. So that affects, and that is fundamentally one of the reasons why the city is given this power, is to be able to attract employees. This is a benefit that we're going to provide. Now, the city also has other mechanisms to take back those dollars. And they, in fact, did take back dollars because we went through a series, a period of time where there were furloughs. They didn't lay people off, but they didn't pay them either. They took back the money in other ways. There were no wage increases. So there are ways in which the city can do it, but again, it all comes down to the ability of a locality to control its own local affairs. The dollars that the state, that the city has, are the same. It doesn't affect the state, per se. What it does do is it gives the city the ability to address the needs that it has as a local matter.
I thought that you look at the statute books, you'll find quite a number of statutes that say if you're a city of the first class, you do it this way. If you're not a city of the first class, you do it this way. And that doesn't affect uniformity, that the state can classify cities and treat them differently.
That has been historically the case with the city of
Milwaukee. Why isn't that your answer to Justice Prosser?
It should be, Your Honor, and I appreciate you.
I have another question, perhaps.
I'll see if I can answer.
And the chief can answer this one, too.
That's right.
If the city of Milwaukee's employees are treated one way, and they don't have to contribute 5.5%, but Milwaukee County employees do, and West Allis employees do, and Butler employees do, and South Milwaukee, and Oak Creek, and all the other communities around Milwaukee, wouldn't that create unrest among the employees?
Well, that's sort of like asking me the fact that people get paid different wages for doing all sorts of things, and doesn't that have the potential for creating unrest? Because we have all sorts of inequities in our society where some people work, you know, long and hard hours at 7 1/4 an hour, and other people, you know, have different jobs and they...
All right. Let me change the question. If you represented the Milwaukee County employees under those fact situations, what would you do?
If I represented Milwaukee County employees?
Yeah.
Unfortunately...
Would you point to fairness?
I would point to the fact that the city is doing this for its employees, as we do every time we negotiate a contract. We go throughout the country and we try and find comparable workers who do comparable work, and we try and find, you know, what benefits they're getting, and we try and build a case to show that our sanitation workers who are doing X are getting paid this amount, and people who do comparable jobs are getting paid more, if that's the case. There are times when maybe they're not getting paid as much. But that's, you know, that's something that we do constantly in negotiations. That doesn't create inequity or unfairness per se.
I have a question just for clarification. The argument, as I understood it, it focuses on 62.623.
That is correct.
There's been discussion regarding uniformity with regard to that particular statute, and of course, whether or not that statute is a violation of the constitutional provision on home rule. So I look to 62.623, which is the statute that is asserted it's in violation of home rule and uniformity, arguably as part of that test. And what do I see? I see paragraph 1, sub 1 of that statute, referring to a employment and employment retirement system of a first-class city. I see sub 2, and I'm asking for clarification because maybe I'm missing something. Sub 2 deals only with non-represented law enforcement or firefighting managerial employee, etc. That's 2A. And 2B deals also with law enforcement or firefighting employee. So where is the provision regarding employee retirement system of all of the rest of the municipal entities against which 62.623 is being compared for uniformity? Where is it? It may be someplace. I'm just missing it. It does not exist. So in other words, Appleton can do what it wants to do? I'm asking.
No, Appleton cannot, because Appleton is subject to the specific prohibitions that are contained within Act 10, if you will, because there was a general prohibition that applied to basically Appleton and everybody else, and then with respect to the city of Milwaukee, there is this specific section, 62.623.
Okay, thank you.
Because it fits with all the other provisions that deal with the retirement system of the first-class city.
Pardon?
Because it fits with the other provisions that deal with the city, the first-class city.
Right. It falls within that section that deals with the first-class.
Right.
And
okay.
It was inserted in that particular point. Now, before I close, and I know that I've gone well beyond my time, but there's the impairment of contract, which we have
quickly
never gotten to at all. But I would point out that with respect to the contractual rights, and as Chief Justice Abramson noted, you went through the different sections, it was clearly and unequivocally that these contractual rights were granted to employees who were employed as of 2000 moving forward until there was a change in the charter ordinance. And as I had indicated earlier in my discussion, Milwaukee negotiated with its unions and changed its charter ordinance on a prospective fashion. It did it the right way. It preserved the contractual obligations it had to its employees. Since that provision in 2011, it created a reservation of rights clause, which it again adopted according to a charter ordinance following the proper procedures, which then gave to the city the ability to do things like what Act 10 is trying to do to the city, which is retroactively change its benefits.
Council, I'd like to ask you a question about language in the Van Gilder versus City of Madison case. And rather than go through all your stack of papers, I promise to read it slowly, and I promise to read it accurately. It, on page 35 and 36, when the legislature deals with local affairs and government of a city, if its act is not to be subordinate to a charter ordinance, the act must be one which affects with uniformity every city. And so your response to that language would be this is not a matter of uniformity?
Correct. My response to that would be if you look at the Van Gilder case and if you look at where the court ended up, it looked at and made its the determining factor was that they were dealing with employees who were protective service employees, and they said that the public safety was a matter of statewide concern. And because it's a matter of statewide concern, we, combined with the fact that there is a uniform act, we are now going to basically tell the city of Madison that you must pay this benefit. And it's because when you read the entire decision, and the part you read was correct, but the whole decision and the seminal turning point was that...
No,
I understand that. I'm just saying that the decision turns on the fact that the court determined public safety was a matter of statewide concern, and because of that, the legislature's ordinance or statute trumped the city's ordinance. And that, quite frankly, has been followed consistently through all of the different cases we've looked at, Ray Rauer and Welter and all of those. When you look at public safety, it's a matter of statewide concern, which gives the legislature the ability to do certain things.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Justices.
Attorney Lester Pines, Cullen Weston, and Pines and Fox, representing Madison Teachers, Inc., Peggy Coyne, Public Employees, Local 61, AFL, CIO, and John Wigman. Counsel.
Chief Justice Abramson, Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court, I'm Lester Pines. I appear on behalf of Madison Teachers, Incorporated, and Peggy Coyne. I know it's already been a long day, and I want to focus my argument and address the issues raised on the collective bargaining aspects of Act 10. And I believe it was Justice Abramson who said that the parties appear to have passed like ships in the night. And the Attorney General said, well, we've got the bigger ship. And what I want to tell, with all due respect to the Attorney General, the Titanic was a big ship, too. And one problem for the Titanic is it ran into an iceberg that was a lot smaller than it was. And it ripped the ship apart and it sank. What Act 10 has run into is the Wisconsin Constitution. And it has violated the Wisconsin Constitution. We're talking about associational rights. The right to associate is protected by the Wisconsin Constitution in Article 1, Section 4. And in fact, that section, which reads, "The right of the people peaceably to assemble, to consult for the common good, and to petition the government or any department thereof, shall never be abridged." It's analogous to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. It protects the right of citizens to associate. We know that there is an associational right in the Wisconsin Constitution. We know that there's a corresponding right in the U.S. Constitution. The right of employees to self-organization and to select representatives of their own choosing for collective bargaining or other mutual protection or coercion by their employer is a fundamental right. Is a fundamental right. That is a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1937 in NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin. The actual quote is, "Thus, in its present application, the statute goes no further." And the statute they were talking about is the National Labor Relations Act. "The statute goes no further than to safeguard the right of employees to self-organization and to select representatives of their own choosing for collective bargaining or other mutual protection without restraint or coercion of the employer." What that case recognized is that the right to associate for mutual aid and protection for collective bargaining exists first. And the National Labor Relations Act and the Municipal Employment Relations Act did not grant employees that associational right. They didn't grant that right. The right pre-existed. Our position is not that there is a constitutional right of collective bargaining. We have never argued that. What we have argued and what is supported by the law is that there is an associational right related to employees coming together for the purpose of that activity and mutual aid and protection. MIRA is nothing more than a regulatory activity. It regulates that pre-existing constitutional right. And that pre-existing constitutional right is a fundamental right, and that right, a fundamental right, as this court recognized in Vincent versus Voight, is a right that is based on the Constitution either explicitly or implicitly, and which the Court of Appeals, our State Court of Appeals, recognized in State versus Martin. Fundamental rights are those which are either explicitly or implicitly based on the Constitution and are rights guaranteed by the First Amendment of the Constitution. So it is absolutely, absolutely the case that the right of association is a fundamental right. It is protected by the Constitution. It is absolutely, absolutely indisputable that all that MIRA does is regulate that right.
You agree, Mr. Pines, that the state need not have any collective bargaining?
The state does not have to do any collective bargaining. That's true.
So if the state just said no collective bargaining at all, the end, would you be here?
If the state said no collective bargaining, no, we would not be here.
Okay. So
I want to point out.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do want to point out that the state in 1955 was not obligated to build public housing either. There was no obligation that the state in Lawson build public housing. There was no constitutional right to public housing.
Okay.
But the state chose
to build public housing. Just as in this case, the state chose, the legislature chose, to create a structure for collective bargaining.
Okay. And in Lawson, they said, okay, you've got a privilege to live in public housing. We didn't have to give it to you. We're going to give it to you, but we can't condition it on your not joining a subversive organization.
That's right. That was the holding in Lawson.
Right.
But the principle in Lawson, is that even when a state engages in an activity that it doesn't have to engage in, it cannot burden an associational right as a basis for the citizen accepting what the state didn't have to do in the first place.
I accept that. But you have to tell me how this has been burdened, how the associational right has been burdened by Act 10.
Okay.
Because let me accept for the moment, you've got a fundamental right to associate for the purposes of your employment, getting better employment, okay, or anything else. You still have that right in Wisconsin. I agree that the state cannot condition a privilege by burdening unfairly burdening a fundamental right. How are you burdened? That's what I don't get.
The state, by passing Act 10, which was an unprecedented act, what the state did, and we're not talking about theoretical associational rights here. We're talking about tens of thousands of people who made this associational choice. They were not placed, as the state argued here, involuntarily into something. They voluntarily chose through elections. What the state has said is, now that you're exercising an associational right, now we're going to penalize you for doing so. This is a huge, huge jump from what the way the state defined collective bargaining before. Now, the state is certainly has the ability to say, all right, we're not going to have areas which are...
How are they penalized? I think that's what the chief...
Here's how they're penalized. Act 10 says you can only talk about wages with us. A municipal employer can only talk about wages. But you can only talk about wages involving a cost of living increase on the base wage. It doesn't say you can talk about wages, and you can talk about a cost of living increase. You can talk about the cost of living increase on the base wage, meaning essentially the starting wage, which means if you choose to participate, you will never get a real wage increase for the rest of your career. That's a penalty. The penalty is the state says, well, the benefit that we provide is we'll talk to you. We don't have to talk to you.
But Mr. Hines, if you're saying that it would be perfectly constitutional for the state to do away with all collective bargaining, how is it in the same breath you can say that it's impermissible to reduce some of the incidences? You used the word talking, but I think you meant bargaining. The matters to be bargained. How can that be impermissible if they can do away with the whole thing?
First of all, I hadn't completely finished my answer about what the penalties were, but the point is this. The state cannot cumulatively burden the right. If you eliminate collective bargaining in its entirety, then every municipal employee is on the same playing field. There is no collective bargaining. The employer is in charge. The employer can recognize any group of employees They can associate, any group of employees can associate and try to talk to the employer. But in this instance, where the employees take advantage of something the state has offered them to do, the state then penalizes them by limiting what they can get. That is, when you talk about wages and you say, well, the state, the municipal employers, they don't have to talk. They don't have to bargain. Okay? But they do. They do. The reality is that while 111.70 was in force, municipal employers talk to their supervisors all the time. There's no collective bargaining for supervisors. There are supervisory agreements all over the place. Here, what's happening is the state has essentially made a decision that it will use the collective bargaining process to so cumulatively burden what they have said you could do that they essentially make it a negative to engage in that activity. That is, if you are an employee and you choose to associate in this activity, you will be penalized. It's not just a matter of saying, well, we won't talk about this or we won't talk about that. They're actively going to penalize you by saying, if you make this associational right, we don't have to build public housing, we don't have to do collective bargaining. But they said, we will do collective bargaining, but if you do it,
you can't ever get a real wage increase. From being in subversive organization.
But you can't ever get a real wage increase. You can't have money withheld from your wages to help to support your associational activity, even though you could have that money withheld to pay to the Boy Scouts, to pay to any other club, to pay to any other association, and you have to spend money every year to prove to us that, in fact, you really are what you say you are.
But you just said, a few moments ago that it's not just a matter of the reduction of the topics to be bargained about.
Right.
But, and then you went on to say, it's the removal of those items to be bargained about that impermissibly, if I'm wrong, correct me, but this is what I heard, that impermissibly burdens the right of the citizen to associate.
No, what I'm saying is, I didn't say that the removal of things that could be bargained about is the burden. What I'm saying is, the burden is the penalty with regard to the negotiation of wages.
How is that any different from what I just said?
Because there's hours and working conditions as well.
There's what?
Hours and working conditions. Hours and working conditions are off the table.
Well, all right. Well, thank you, Mr. Pines.
Let's try it a different way. Suppose the Act 10 merely said that in collective bargaining, using the definition in the statute of collective bargaining, you could only deal with wages, not anything else, period. And there's no limitation on the wages. You're not tied to the base wages or starting wage. You're not tied to the consumer price index. Just a blanket. You can collectively bargain only on wages. What's your position then? Absent the rest of it.
It would be constitutional.
It would be constitutional. You're saying that by limiting the wages and making it look great, tying it to the consumer price index, what could be fairer than that? But you're saying the way it's worded so that you'd start with the base wage, starting wage, that you tie it to the consumer price index and you add a referendum, right?
Yes.
You're saying all that spells you're never going to get a wage increase.
That's correct.
And that is a penalty for the employees who are in collective bargaining. That's correct. Is that your argument?
That's part of the argument. And then in addition to that penalty, the statute also then, by restricting the ability of the employee to direct dues to the collective bargaining agent or to the union, which is the collective bargaining agent, that further impedes the associational activity. And then by imposing a financial burden of a yearly election with a super, super majority, a majority by which none of you could be elected.
Well, don't get on that territory.
You know, a you majority have to realize. Of everybody who could vote, not the majority of the people who do vote, none of you would be elected. No
the,
elected
the
official would be elected.
The seven of us might disagree, but you have your opinion.
Some of us might not have opposition.
But just think about this.
You might not get elected anyway.
If 50% of the people vote, if 50% of the people vote in a spring election.
They don't.
All right, let's say 30% of the people vote in a spring election. Less. 15%? For any of you to get elected, you'd still have to get 51% of the entire electorate.
Well, we won't join a collective bargaining union.
But I think when you look at it this way, you can see this isn't a benign provision. This isn't benign. This provision is designed to make it impossible, practically, for the people who have chosen to exercise their associational right to be able to continue to exercise it.
But what I hear you saying, Mr. Pines, is let's say hypothetically the legislature goes back into session and they pass a law that says no more collective bargaining, and the governor signs it. That's perfectly constitutional. And then the next session they come back and they say, well, you know what, we're going to pass some legislation that gives some collective bargaining rights, and that's going to be the ability to bargain for base wage. That's fine? I mean, constitutionally?
Theoretically, that's fine. We're not talking necessarily.
I just thought I was repeating your argument or saying it in different words.
If the legislature were to abolish collective bargaining, okay?
Yeah.
Then all municipal employees would be on the same plane. All right? Right now, those people who choose the associational activity are not. They're not on the same plane. Okay? They are those who choose are penalized. They're penalized as we've described it. So it's this legislation.
That gets us back, though.
Okay.
The natural consequence of where you're going gets us back to where we started, which is that the state is recognizing the constitutional right to unionize. And so what you're going to say is, well, yes, they're recognizing the right of association, but they're so burdening it as to infringe on the First Amendment freedom of association.
And here I think is an important distinction, Justice Gableman. What you have now is you have tens of thousands of people, tens of thousands of members of unions who have made this associational choice.
Who have made what?
Who have made this associational choice. They are union members. They've made the associational choice. The purpose of Act 10 is to so burden that associational choice that essentially, by limiting what is available, by requiring no dues deduction, by requiring these expensive elections, the legislature is essentially setting up the circumstance where the employees themselves, because there's no economic motivation to continue that associational choice, the employees themselves, in order to get back on the same plane with non-unionized employees, will have to abandon their associational choice.
But that's different, isn't it, in kind from Lawson, where it was an affirmative prohibition on the joining or belonging to subversive groups.
But that's a distinction without a difference. Because affirmatively in Lawson, they said, here, you can live in this public housing. It's okay, as long as you don't do this. Okay.
Right.
In this instance, they say, you can make this associational choice, but if you do, we're going to hit you over the head with a baseball bat. Okay? We're going to penalize you. We're going to make it so difficult for you economically that you're going to walk away from that associational choice. It's the two sides of the same, of the two sides of a coin. In Lawson, it's affirmatively, you've got to abandon it. In Act 10, it's negatively, we're going to make you abandon it because we're going to make it so difficult for you to maintain it, you're going to walk from it.
Counselor, you know, the case really turns on whether the plaintiff appellants have proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Act 10 and 32 are unconstitutional. Agreed? Earlier we talked about the level of scrutiny, and I know that's very important to Justice Crooks, and he sees it as an important key to this case. Do you agree that it is an important key?
It is certainly an important key with regard to the equal protection argument.
And do you agree that if the court were to apply a rational basis test to this law, that the plaintiff appellants cannot prevail?
With regard to the equal protection argument, we took that position.
Okay,
yes.
I take that as a maybe. Okay. So what I take from that also is that you think that you can prevail in some part of your claim based on a rational basis.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Would you explain that to me, please?
I'm sorry. I'm based on the rational basis test.
Oh.
No.
Oh, okay.
We take that position.
So what's your other claim other than equal protection?
Well,
it's association.
It's associational claim. The equal protection claim, which is not a claim that the state addressed in its argument, is this. You've got two sets of municipal employees, one of which is exercising an associational right. And those municipal employees who are not. And what the state has done, what the legislature has done, is to say, for those who have exercised an associational right, you'll never get a wage increase for the rest of your career, real wage increase, because this isn't a cost of living increase. This is a cost of living increase on the base. If you start at $30,000 a year, if your salary when Act 10 was enacted was $70,000 a year, you're only going to get a cost of living increase on the $30,000. You're never going to get a real wage increase because you're not going to get a cost of living increase on what you're actually making. Compare that to the similarly situated non-unionized employee who the employer is free to give any wage increase of any amount. Well, the response to that is, well, no, the employer can give an increased wage increase to a person who's unionized, except that then that proposal of the employer has to be submitted to a referendum with wording that essentially says, do you really want to give these people a raise? Whereas any other municipal employee can get any wage that the employer wants to give. And this whole idea, by the way, that people in a collective bargaining unit can go and negotiate their own contract, that's not accurate. That is, there's a sole and exclusive bargaining agent, so people can't go, especially when there's a contract in force, they can't just go and negotiate. But the idea that if you exercise a right, if you have an associational right, the state recognizes that you can participate in this regulated activity, but then they then make what is going on within that regulated activity so negative in comparison to what people similarly situated are getting, that is a burden on that associational right, and there is no compelling interest for it. The state has admitted there's no compelling interest for it. There's no compelling interest to maintain this distinction between these two similarly situated employees.
I understand that to be your argument in part with regard to equal protection. What I did not understand is your answer to Justice Rogenczak. You indicated that you're making a strict scrutiny argument, and it's important with regard to equal protection.
It seems
to me that you were also making it with regard to a First Amendment association right violation.
That's correct. Because in the absence of a violation of a fundamental right, has to be viewed by through strict scrutiny.
You start out with, and I'm dealing with the same issue, I think, that Justice Bradley is. You start out with the concept there's a presumption in favor of the state. If you've got a fundamental right, which you say is association, and that is being burdened in some fashion, then you get into that the burden shifts.
That's correct.
Isn't that right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So there's no longer, once, if we should agree that there's a fundamental right, and if we agree that there's a burden, right?
Right.
Then there is no presumption of constitutionality. The burden falls on the state to show that it has a compelling interest, right?
Right.
That it hasn't burdened the right. And if it has burdened the right, then it has to be done in a restricted manner to fit what the goal is for the compelling state interest.
That's correct.
So that's why you don't worry, I say that loosely, about the presumption, because you're going in on the concept you've got a fundamental right and the presumption's gone.
That's right. And we argue this in our brief, so it's not something that I'm adopting here on oral argument.
Yes, I understood that. That's why it seemed a little in tension with your brief.
I won't explain how I answered the question wrong, but I did. What I was saying was...
Right, we're here to help you.
Thank you. Apparently, a lot of us up here need help today.
I'm trying.
I got to tell you, it's not as easy as it looks.
You know, this isn't either.
We know that if the court finds that there is a fundamental right that's been abridged here, that the state has not attempted to and will not attempt to and cannot show that there is a compelling interest for these infringements on that right. We know that both on the issue of the fundamental right, we know that on the equal protection argument. And what I was saying was, with regard to the equal protection analysis, if there is no finding of a fundamental right, that only the rational interest test applies. So I just want to make sure that I've stated our position clearly on that. I see my time is up, although it's hard for me to tell, frankly.
I have a question for you. You said in your brief and you said here that I guess it would be the school board in this case, allows for deductions from your payroll to other entities.
Right.
And but selects out unions.
Yes.
How is that? You view that as a violation of the associational rights by putting a penalty on the union?
Only in the cumulative context of Act 10. That is, as was briefed, we know that there is precedent which says if you say that a public employer does not have to withhold wages if it's authorized by an employee, that's not unconstitutional. We know that that's the case.
Because this is a subsidy issue.
Yes. However, that prohibition cannot be taken out of the context of the totality of the cumulative nature of what Act 10 does to the associational rights. You know, in, I think it was the Usura case, what the court said was, yeah, the state doesn't have to do this. Okay, that was an isolated thing. But here we have a cumulative number of activities all put together. The limitation of a potential pay increase to cost of living on the base wage, a limitation on the ability of the employer to do something voluntarily that it might want to do without going to a referendum with language that makes it virtually impossible to get the citizens to vote for it because of how it describes the cost of living. And then, on top of that, you add in, as another cumulative aspect of this, the fact that people who make this associational choice, who have won an election previously, then have to have another election which costs them money on top of everything else, and then they have to provide whatever services they can provide to people who don't have to contribute anything to those services being provided. So it is an entire package that was passed by the legislature, and it was going to be passed after being introduced on a Thursday. It was going to be passed on the next Tuesday. The legislature put this together. They knew what they were doing. They knew exactly what this accumulation of burdens would be. And the purpose of it, and I'll come back, Justice Gableman, to your point, the purpose of it was not to get people to have to sign something to say, we don't want to exercise this associational right, but the purpose of it was to squeeze them in such a way that they would have to abandon it, to penalize them by adding on all of these burdens. Then they have to say, we're done with this because what's the point? And that's what Act 10 did. That's the infringement of Act 10.
You know, most of your argument has gone to the individual employees, as I hear you.
Yes.
But the associations themselves, the unions themselves, have rights.
Yes.
The association itself has the right to exist. The association itself has the right to represent people who want to be represented. And the last time I looked under Citizens United, the association is a person and has free speech. And you all cited Citizens Union for something or other. And it seemed to me that the argument is also that the association's free association with its members, the association's free speech, has been impinged by these items in this Act 10.
To this extent, the
I was looking at the NAACP case and those in that line.
And to this extent, this law was not passed in a vacuum. That is, at the time that the law was passed, there were multiple public employee unions that represented municipal employees. And to the extent that those unions have associational rights, under Citizens United, I guess they have free speech rights, and now the U.S. Supreme Court's being asked to figure out whether they have the right for free exercise of religion, too. Those unions which existed, which were functioning, which were the heart and soul of the associational activities of the members, then were told by the legislature, your member, you can only do one thing for your members, which is negotiate nothing, negotiate no real wage increase, and your members can't pay you the dues in the way that you have been paid, and you're going to have to run an election and get money from somewhere to run that election every year to prove to us that you really exist, even though we know that you've existed for all these years, and you're going to have to provide services to people that never have to pay for them. And so, most certainly, the effect of this legislation is to burden the activities of the unions and to burden the individual activities of the individuals in the unions, which have relied on them for a few decades now, to vindicate and assist them in vindicating their associational rights. So this is not a benign, this is not a benign piece of legislation.
How often should recertification elections be held, in your view?
In my view, I'm not a member of the legislature,
Is your chance.
Okay. If the legislature wanted to have recertification elections every year and said, you know, every year the members should get together and they should say, we want to have a union, we don't have a union, then have a fair election. Here's an election. Do people want to have a union? And people come and they vote. And the people who vote, and they win. Whoever wins, wins. Majority. So if 10% of the people come and vote, fine. It's not the yearly election that's the issue. It's the manner in which the legislature has prescribed that this election take place, which is really a non-election. Because it's so extraordinary in American society that it's actually unthinkable that you would impose this kind of burden to say you got to get an absolute majority of everybody, even if they don't come to vote. So in other words, people who don't vote, it's a no vote. Nothing like that has ever been passed, as far as I can tell, anywhere.
Kind of like corporate bylaws, isn't it? What you have to do when you change articles of incorporation. You got to get a majority of the shareholders to go along with stuff like that. So in a way, it's got, certainly not in this kind of a context, but it does happen.
Well, it does happen, although corporations are not really considered to be democratic in the way that unions are supposed to be considered democratic.
Well, I understand. It's not
you know, by the way, the legislature didn't account for proxies either. There's no proxy voting in Act 10. You got to show up.
You know, there's a series of cases that indicate you can't govern, the state can't govern the internal operations of a voluntary association in this manner. Does that have any effect?
That's not something that we've considered or briefed, okay. And I can't comment on it. Thank you. I see that my time is up, unless there are other questions.
There are not. Thank you, Mr. Pines. General Van Hollen.
May it please the court, I'm prepared for my 5 minutes of rebuttal to the 3 hours of response. Obviously, there are so many things I'd like to address, and I can't even begin to address them all, so I will try to hit a few high points if I can. First of all, there are a few statements in error of Mr. Pines that I think need to be corrected, and they really go to the heart of the matter. When they try to win this case on the Lawson analogy and try to show that not only was there an association that was interfered with, but it was an unconstitutional condition that interfered with it, I think we have to look at all three aspects of those things that it's their burden to establish. First of all, we have to clarify the difference between a union and a collective bargaining unit and their elected representative. They are very different. They enjoy different protections under the law. They are clearly different with regards to voluntariness and involuntariness. The association we're talking about is within the collective bargaining unit, and it is not a voluntary association. No association rights of union members has been affected by this Act 10 whatsoever. The second issue is, if there is no associational violation, how can there be a constitutional violation of their associational rights? And whereas they may want to argue that an accumulation of what they call penalties or burdens on the unions may, they believe, cause an unconstitutional condition, the courts have been clear from as far back as the Federal Labor Credit Union or the federal labor case in 1949 that making union membership less desirable and failing to do unions fundraising for them is not unconstitutional and is not expected by the government. There is not an associational violation. It's not even a voluntary association. There's certainly not an unconstitutional violation since they're not associating for the purposes of a fundamental right because collective bargaining repeatedly is not, and we all agree. But very importantly as well, is there is not a burden. Unequivocally, if the unions did not have the ability to be collective bargaining representatives and collectively bargain for any issues whatsoever in the state of Wisconsin, And what are now represented employees were the same as non-represented employees. All of them would have the First Amendment right to go to their employer and ask for all sorts of different things, changes in working conditions, increased wages, changes in hours, and the list goes on and on. The employer may or may not listen. If you read the amicus brief from the City of Madison, you will realize that employers very much want to listen and to make sure that they retain good employees. Well, in this case, the represented employees still retain every one of those First Amendment rights. They're not at all burdened or penalized by voting to have a collective bargaining representative represent their collective bargaining unit. They are benefited because in addition to the ability to negotiate for all of those other things, if the employer would negotiate, they can force the employer to come to the table and bargain in good faith over, albeit a limited subset, but they can force them to bargain for something. They have an advantage. If they didn't have an advantage, they wouldn't be here arguing to defend it and get it back.
General Van Hollen, is it correct that the raise would, the wage increase would be on the starting wage, not on the actual wages of employees?
Your Honor, I honestly don't know that. But what I can tell you is there is no cap on wages, as was said. You know, repeatedly it was said that, well, it's unreasonable to believe that they can go to a referendum and get the increase in wages. Well, they can. And I don't remember a referendum process ever being held as being unconstitutional. They're not being unconstitutionally burdened because they have to go to a referendum to be able to collectively bargain for higher than the base wages, whatever they are, Your Honor.
Mr. Attorney General, you said in your argument they are not associating for the purpose of a fundamental right. Is it your belief that the test of whether or not there is an associational right is premised upon whether or not the purpose of exercising that right is a fundamental right?
Constitutional right, yes. That's what was held in Roberts v. J.C.'s. And
so if they want to get together to collect stamps,
the unions can get together and associate for whatever purposes they want. They can even get together and associate for the purposes of using their First Amendment rights to approach the employers as a group and try to convince the employers that they should give higher wages than under collective bargaining. What they can't do, what they don't have a constitutional right to do, is to force the employer to sit at the table and bargain with them in good faith over certain issues collectively as a collective bargaining
so
representative.
Your shift, so to speak, and I still actually see the two of you passing, and it's on this very point that you apparently are of the belief that there is no constitutional right of association unless that right of association is being exercised for the purpose of a fundamental right, and your opposing counsel sees, much like the Court of Appeals certification indicated, that there is a fundamental right of association that is the right of an individual citizen to associate together for the purpose of advocating regarding matters of mutual interest or concern, in particular matters concerning wages and employment conditions. You don't, I mean, you just see it.
Well, no, I agree with all of what you just read, Your Honor.
So you think there is a fundamental.
There is an associational right for the unions to get together and do all those things.
So this was an right of an individual citizen to associate.
It is. We are talking, by and large, when we're talking about associational rights or constitutional rights, we are talking about individual citizens. That's being grown into individual citizens who collect together and form a union and how they exercise their rights in collection, of course. But, no, I agree with the certification. The unions have the opportunity and they have the associational rights to gather together for the individuals who want to join a union for all of those reasons. Those reasons do not include for the purposes of forcing an employer to sit down and bargain collectively with a collective bargaining representative over issues beyond the issue of base wages. That is where the associational line is drawn. And another place that it's drawn, and please permit me to finish this thought out, the other place where it's drawn is we are talking about the rights of the union to associate for all of these different reasons. On the other hand, what Act 10 talks about is the right of people within a collective bargaining unit to associate for the purposes of electing a representative to negotiate on these limited issues. Those are very, very distinct and different issues under the law and under Act 10.
Yeah, the focus of the Court of Appeals, however, would take, in the excerpt that I read about individual, the rights of an individual citizen, would take exception to you transposing that just to unions. I say that because the very first sentence of their discussion and terminology, we begin our more detailed summary of the issues by clarifying our use of the term collective bargaining and explaining why we largely avoid using the term union. And then they go on to explain that. So they focus the discussion of the fundamental right that's constitutionally protected as an associational right of individual citizens without using and going to the term.
Actually, I believe they went into a lot of discussion of collective bargaining, some of which was addressed in questioning in my opening statement, two different types of collective bargaining. It's very clear. Act 10 doesn't talk about this general term that we historically can talk about, that we can get together collectively and we can bargain. We use those terms in normal parlance. Act 10 talks about collectively bargaining, the two words together as a defined statutory term.
Right. And that's what the court
And they explain the differences. Yeah. Absolutely.
There's associational right and to get together.
So they use the word representative, don't they?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The Court of Appeals uses the word representative instead of union or collective bargaining entity. So do you think there's a fundamental right of employees to associate associate to select representatives and have representatives to get them wage increases?
I'm sorry, I have to ask you to repeat that, Your Honor.
Do you think there's a fundamental right of employees to associate for the purposes of selecting representatives, as used by the Court of Appeals, to get wage increases?
There is a there's a fundamental right of free association amongst employees to gather together in unions, for instance, to try to get wage increases.
Hey, let's get away from unions.
I can't. The podium's affixed right next to him, Your Honor.
We can move it to the other side. We're very flexible. Here's the deal. There's a fundamental right to associate, to select representatives for purposes of getting wage increases. Doesn't have to be a union. I can gather together 50 friends and call it the XYZ, and I want you, XYZ, to represent me in getting wages. Isn't that a fundamental right?
Free association, First Amendment right, absolutely right.
Right. So the question then is, they have a fundamental right to get a representative to do a wage increase under Act 10. Then the question is, once you get into a fundamental right, is that right unduly burdened by all the items that MTI is complaining about? Because now you have conceded that there's a fundamental right to associate for wages.
We're conflating another term. We've conflated many in the past, collective bargaining, unions, and others. The representative to which you refer, that people, anybody can get together and have represent them, is not the same as the representative as the term is used in Act 10, is used in MIRA, as I believe is used by the Court of Appeals.
I'm going to get XYZ, and I'm going to certify him under Act 10. Act 10 isn't limited to unions, is it?
Act 10 really has nothing to do with unions.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's a fundamental right to associate, to select representatives to get wage increases.
Not within collective bargaining. outside of collective bargaining to attempt to do so? Absolutely. And both represented and non-represented employees have that fundamental right.
Mr. Van Hollen, I wonder if you could address some of the arguments made by Mr. Padway in regard to home rule. During his argument, he made the observation, as I have written it anyway, that shared revenue is not dependent, the amount of shared revenue that the city of Milwaukee would receive is not dependent on how much it pays its employees. And so I apologize, Mr. Padway, if I'm butchering your argument, but I think I'm pretty close. He says it's budget neutral, and the city gets the same amount of money from the state either way. So does that go to the uniformity aspect? How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, I don't think that that is necessarily the best way to address the uniformity aspect. I mean, the uniformity aspect is quite clear and simple. Home rule doesn't apply if we have a law, in this case an act.
I said uniformity. It should have been statewide concern. Statewide concern. In other words, why should it be a matter of statewide concern if Madison is going to send, if the state is going to send the same amount of money to Milwaukee one way or the other?
Because the state is very concerned with the resources and the financial constraints that were imposed upon every part of the state of Wisconsin. The city of Milwaukee, despite what some arguments and contracts and home rule might want to make, is not a state within a state. It's never intended to be, nor is it ever going to be. And the reality is if we look at their finances in a vacuum, from a financial perspective at least, that's what we are creating. We have shared revenue. We have state aids. We have grants. We have all sorts of different things that go to the city of Milwaukee, things that we believe they need based upon the fact that they need additional revenue to do the things that are of interest to the state as a whole. So whenever the state would, or whenever the locality would be spending the money in a manner in which the state believed was perhaps imprudent, it can impact all the other things that occur within the city.
Well, but if, do you agree with the idea that it, or do you agree with the statement that the city's pension system and how it pays its employees is budget neutral? As far as state revenue goes?
Is budget neutral? Well, no.
Yes.
No, absolutely not.
From the state standpoint?
From the state standpoint, it's not budget neutral because the more expenditures they have, the less expenditures they have to do other things that are of great statewide concern, as were upheld in Van Gilder and so many other places.
I see.
Well, if you keep following that argument, what's left of home rule?
What's left of home rule is what was anticipated to be of home rule in the first place, and that is that municipalities have the opportunity to rule and to govern in a void. In areas where the legislature has not dictated what they can or can't do, they have the opportunity to do certain things.
But the legislature can then do anything. If it does that.
Circumstances, they can do anything if they pass a law with applies with uniformity throughout the state of Wisconsin.
But once
or
uniform,
if they pass something that they believe is statewide concern, correct.
So if they pass something dealing with shoreland zoning, for example.
Well, I think very appropriately they think the legislature will hold that the issues of shoreland zoning are a statewide concern. Obviously, water resources, you know, the list goes on and on when you come to water. So, yes, absolutely they could.
Are there any other questions?
You have another hour.
Thank you, everyone.
No, you don't. Thank you, Attorney General Van Hollen, and I want to thank the other people who argued, Deputy Attorney General Evan St. John, Attorney Tamara Packard, Nicole Padway, and Lester A. Pines, not only for their briefs and their arguments, but their stamina. And that ends the hearing on 12AP 2067, Madison Teachers, Inc. versus Scott Walker. I've been asked to extend our time period from a half hour. How about an hour? Will that do it or less? 3:20.
Less.
4 o'clock?
Sure.
court will meet in closed session at 4 p.m. This is our, at the moment, final oral argument in November, so we are adjourned for oral arguments.